From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made earlier this month when four local organizations that serve homeless adults and children learned that they will lose more than $500,000 in funding. We're talking state, federal funding. It's the YWCA of Rochester and Monroe County, Spiritus Christi Church, the Salvation Army of Greater Rochester, and Volunteers of America. They serve 2,000 homeless adults and children in our area at least. And of course, that population fluctuates. They all receive state funding through the Solutions to End Homelessness Program, or STEP, which helped them provide emergency, transitional, or permanent housing for homeless families. And that money, $550,000, is now being redirected to permanently house 15% of the homeless population, or so they say. But leaders of the local organizations losing the funding say that without that grant money, their programs could be suffering. As the winter months approach, the news leaves both those leaders and the families they serve looking for solutions. And this hour, it's not just about the cuts. This hour, we want to take our gaze at the entire population of homeless individuals and families in the Rochester and the greater Rochester area. We know that some of the roughest months of the year are coming with winter. So we'll talk about the cuts, but we'll also talk about the work being done at these organizations as they try to serve this population. So hello to our guests in studio. Let me say hello to Angela Panzarella, who's the president and CEO of the YWCA of Rochester and Monroe County. Angela, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Evan, thank you very much for having me.
Good to have you. Also with us is John Souza with the Salvation Army of Greater Rochester. He's the Liberty Pole Way officer for them. John, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Anna Valeria Eisman is the executive director of the Open Door Mission in Rochester. Anna, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Reverend Myra Brown, the senior pastor at Spiritus Christi Church in Rochester. Reverend, welcome. Thanks for being back here.
Great to be here with you, Evan.
And with us is Sarah Lee, who is the director of Jennifer House at Spiritus Christi Church. It serves women reentering the community from prison or jail. Sarah, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
So a lot to get to, and I just kind of want to start with one important point here. I was talking before the program began with Angela, among others, about, number one, how quickly these cuts set in, and number two, when you knew about it. I mean, we are staring down the roughest stretch of the year. And you found out when?
We found out about Labor Day weekend that our funding that we've been receiving for the past 5 years was going to be terminated, and our funding would end at the end of September. So we were given 3 weeks' notice of these cuts.
How much are we talking about with the YWCA?
$175,000 a year. And that funding went for us to support about 5 staff positions partially or fully funded for operating our shelter and efforts we were doing for rapid rehousing for people experiencing homelessness to help them transition into permanent housing in the community.
So, look, you know, I'm going to sound like an advocate, and I don't mean to, actually. I mean, I try to be a journalist, but I'm a human being, so I'm going to ask you a question that comes to my mind first. How in the world could no one have given you more than 3 weeks' notice? I don't get it.
Well,
and I don't mean to be flippant. I don't get it.
We were puzzled as well. We all applied for renewal of our 5-year funding much earlier in the year. We were waiting to receive some word from the state. Unfortunately, that process we were waiting took longer than we expected, and we got notice. Now, we did get a small reprieve from the state. In our case, we had a little bit of the grant money that had not yet been spent, and they're giving us a couple of weeks, about 2 months, to finish spending down that money. But, you know, we really did not have that notice, and it's going to be a big shift for us.
Should your state legislators have prepared you better that this could be coming?
You know, I can't comment about what the state legislators knew or didn't know. The process of assessing how that money was going to be spent this time around for funding was made within the agency level. We certainly would have appreciated more notice, but regardless of whether that notice, frankly, was a couple weeks or a few months, without a long-term solution, we're still left with the challenge of a gap that we don't know how to fill.
Okay. And as you say, you know, you're not sure what they knew or didn't know. I do want listeners to try to do our best to understand exactly whose decision this was. Whose decision was this, Angela?
Well, as far as we understand, this was a funding that was managed by the Office of Temporary Disability Assistance within New York State. We received some feedback from the grant managers who reviewed the program, and what we understand was that they had a limited pot of money. The number of applications were greatly increased this time around from the last time the funding was doled out. And they gave priority to communities that homeless operations, homeless shelter operations that were not receiving county funding in their communities. And they shifted some priorities for funding for outreach program and prevention programs. Now, in Monroe County, most of the shelter operations in our community receive some funding from the county, a per diem reimbursement. That per diem reimbursement was set in light of what we were each receiving from the state. The state made a decision to cut our funding because we were receiving some money from the county. So we are now left in the middle with no funding from the state and limited funding from the county, and again, a gap.
What are you going to do?
Oh, we're going back to the state to try to see if there's any recourse there. We'll try. I'm not optimistic. We're certainly reaching out to private funders where we can to seek some funding. We're also going back to the county and asking the county to reconsider the reimbursement rate that they're paying. Because one way or another, if we can't service the population, if we have to shut beds, that's going to put an impact on the county one way or another. They may need to shift population to hotels, which are more expensive, and certainly a much less effective alternative.
Different organizations do different things, and throughout this hour, all of our guests are going to talk about the services they provide and the work that they're doing. And I know you don't like to do this, but give me the worst-case scenario with these cuts and where you are now. Who is going to be impacted if the worst-case scenario happens?
The worst-case scenario is that we either need to scale back or potentially even discontinue our homeless program. For our population, that will we typically serve nearly 600 individuals each year, women and families, and in fact, we have at least half of the people we serve each year are children. That leaves more pressure on whatever shelters remain, and certainly more pressure on the county, who are already placing many individuals every day in hotels because there was not enough capacity in the community as it was.
And, look, I don't mean to be trite or even cable newsy about this, but I do want to ask you if you are angry or if you're more confused and if you think that this is just a misunderstanding.
I think the state unfortunately made decisions about how to prioritize the funding at a macro level. I certainly would urge the state to, when they're making decisions of this kind, to seek input from the communities. In Monroe County, we've got a very effective process and group together to come together of agencies and government officials to assess what the needs are in our community to serve the homeless population. I'm frustrated because I think the state made the decision with, I understand, limited funds and lots of demands for those funds, but I think they made the decision without really listening to the communities.
All right, let's go around the table. John Sosa, next up, he's with the Salvation Army of Greater Rochester. And John is not the person whose job is to crunch all of the numbers. But my understanding, John, is we're talking nearly $250,000 for the Salvation Army lost in this funding. You do some of the work on the ground. What are your biggest concerns about the impact here?
Well, yeah, I'm more boots on the ground. Just Sunday night, I was actually in Tent City, just off of Broad Street. They call it Peaceful Village, but we were out there just feeding people and giving them clothes and hats and things like that. And my fear is to see that as we lose beds, as we lose services, we're going to see more people out there in places like Tent City. And I've actually had the opportunity to go inside a few of those tents, and it's really sad and heartbreaking to see how people live. And we got thousands of people driving by in their cars every day, not realizing on the other side of that fence there are people just living in filth and misery. And my fear is just to see people, more people out there.
Is that inevitable with these cuts?
I would imagine so. I can't really forecast the trickle-down effect, but I know for our own local Salvation Army, we're going to lose beds. Clients are going to lose services. Perhaps some of our case managers will lose jobs. I just moved here from Ohio 3 months ago to work with the homeless. I come with about 20 years of experience of working out there in the streets, under bridges, in the woods, and I might lose my job. I don't know. I'm not really sure how this trickle-down effect's going to happen, but it's definitely, when you lose $250,000, we're definitely going to feel the pain.
John, Is there any, you know, is there any excuse for giving the agencies so little notice here and this close to winter? I mean, do you feel at the very least that communication could have been better?
I would imagine so. I know my bosses were very heartbroken and very concerned. In fact, many of the employees from the Salvation Army are at the divisional headquarters right now in Syracuse trying to figure out what we're going to do. So I think we're all kind of taken back. Mm-hmm. I know I was. Again, I just moved here 3 months ago, and I might be packing my bags.
Wow. Let me turn to the team from Spiritus Christi Church, Reverend Myra Brown, the senior pastor, and Sarah Lee is the director of Jennifer House at Spiritus Christi Church. Sarah, can you grab that mic, pull it close, and tell me a little bit about what Jennifer House is specifically and the work that you're doing there?
So specifically, Jennifer House addresses the issues of institutional discharges of homeless women released from jail and the burden that the community that they have in the community. We also have a men's house, Nielsen House, located on West Avenue. And our organization has served 492 homeless people, ex-offenders, that struggle with the reentry process and need the services wrapped around for successful transition back into the community. 231 of those 492 folks were not receiving any help from the DHS county or benefits at some point during their stay. And so the STEP grant is, you know, the funding that we used to help support them. We utilize it for case management, transportation services to get back and forth to appointments, food. So across the board, the cut is, you know, it's heartbreaking and it's kind of devastating. And I mean, we have to take a look at the gaps. This isn't the only thing that the state came in and did with Spiritus specifically this year. Last year, they came and did an audit and they said that we needed to have an awake overnight staff in which we had a live-in staff member. Mm-hmm. And they said that it was a recommendation that we take the staff member out and hire staff to come in and do an overnight. And we did that. And that cut our budget that was $60,000 into our budget. And then they came back just the past couple months and they said, oh, that wasn't something you had to do. It was something we just suggested you might want to do. And that was not it during the audit. That was not, you know, the attitude. That was not the behavior. That was not the census that we got from. So that on top of the STEP is really hurting us.
The STEP money, by the way, more than $30,000.
Yeah,
from what I'm reading.
$32,000.
Okay.
$657 to be exact. But yeah, and that's a year. We've been getting that every year for the past 5 years.
So I know, again, people don't like to do this, but this is important for the community to understand. The worst case scenario now is without that funding, what happens?
So we go back to the drawing board, kind of like Angela was saying, and we take a look at the gaps and we take a look at, you know, other funders. We never want to go into any year, fiscal year, thinking that we have money solidified being a nonprofit and knowing that, you know, we're always seeking more opportunities for funding. But it is heartbreaking when you find out, you know, it's funding that you've been receiving and you know that it's going for a good cause and it's going to help minimize the amount of homelessness we have. You know, we have wonderful efforts on the ground. We have advocacy in the Homeless Service Network. We have a bunch of different venues where we get together and we try to tackle this homelessness issue that we have in here in Rochester and in Monroe County. And it's very difficult to do that when we're not getting the support from the state or the county or both in order to be able to be effective.
All right. So the women that you serve in particular, what happens to them without this funding and this help?
So, like I said, we provide transportation, food supply. We might have to lower the numbers on the amount of women that we allow in. It just depends on, you know, somewhere in the wash it comes out, you know, and we try to avoid it being catastrophic. But at this point, like I said, with this being such a nuance, that we are going to go back, our board will go back and we'll take a look at it as an organization as a whole and try to alleviate as much burden as we can. You know, but we're talking about a very vulnerable population that is already burdened so much already. I mean, if you look at the numbers and you look at the way and how people transition from reentry, there are a lot of obstacles. There are a lot of obstacles for men and women, specifically coming from jails and prisons. They have a background and have a criminal record and have stigmas, you know, attached to some of their issues. And so this is just added on, you know, and we'll try to work through it. And, you know, I have hope that we will. It's just very heartbreaking and concerning.
So how many people are you talking about in serving through this program?
So we serve 492 homeless people through this program. Okay. And 231 of those, like I said prior, is, you know, didn't have any benefits or nothing.
Yeah.
So some of the, you know, a lot of serving them, the funding came from, you know, this grant.
Can I ask Pastor Brown to grab the microphone? It's a packed studio with organizations that serve homeless populations here in Rochester. And Pastor Brown, you know, your work crosses over into a lot of different parts of our community, and you try to bridge gaps. So I'm wondering if you feel blindsided by this, or if you feel there are conversations that could still be had regarding this, or is this sort of a settled issue in your mind now?
Yeah, no, I can't personally say that I feel blindsided by it, because I think that Jim Smith, our director, is in constant conversation with state partners, mm-hmm. and county partners, and always trying to have these conversations. And I think I am hopeful. I mean, I think we're always, every time I talk to Jim, he's constantly writing new grants. Like, this was a 5-year grant. And with grants, I mean, you never know. Like, they don't really have a permanency to them. And so you're always having to worry about and wonder whether or not it'll be renewed for, and how long it'll be renewed for, and who else could you pursue to try to make up some of that funding. And so we're constantly, like, we spend our weekly meetings with our outreach directors, you know, whether it's prison outreach or it's recovery or it's our mental health center, really thinking about that, like, in any given day we could lose funding taking care of the vulnerable that we've committed ourselves to, and we have to I think it's just a state of vulnerability that you always find yourself in when you're doing the work I think that all of us are doing.
Yeah, so let me ask you sort of the big picture question then, because on one hand, you may have listeners think, well, just we need to increase funding. We're not funding programs enough. And on the other hand, you may have this idea, this push-pull of limited sources of funding, and I understand there's lots of budgeting decisions that have to be made. I don't know a whole lot of people who are glad to see people suffer or dealing with homelessness. So where are we as a community and as a state and actually dealing with this problem, and how do you think we're doing with grappling with this?
Yeah, I think I am deeply proud of the Rochester community, because I think we have a community that wrestles deeply with this problem. I mean, you have these folks at the table, and I think we rely a lot on each other. Like, I have done referrals to folks to the Y and folks to Salvation Army. I mean, I think there's such an interconnectedness here, and I think this city, like no other city, I think have leaders like what you have at this table that have been working diligently trying to address this problem. I think it's a big problem, and I do think there's a tension, and I think we're on this journey trying to figure it out. There are a lot of people in our city who are struggling with homelessness, who are struggling with these really deep needs, and I think that we have to keep trying to figure it out and bring our best thinking to it. And I think we have to require more of ourselves and more of our state and county leaders, because this is our city, this is our problem, and these are our people, and this is our responsibility. And so I have to remain hopeful that we can figure this out.
Anna Valeria Eisman is the executive director of the Open Door Mission, which was not a STEP recipient, but my understanding is applied for it. Mm-hmm. So no direct impact with cuts like this, but how do you see the impact here? And tell me a little bit about Open Door's relationship with STEP and what you wanted to do there.
We have just opened, as many know, a transitional housing facility for women and children. We've also opened up shelter beds for women in the past 2 years. And we decided to apply for STEP because we're realizing that it may be a really critical funding source to be able to sustain our program that we opened. We were prepared to fund it without STEP because we knew that it was probably a 50-50 chance. And but we were waitlisted. We weren't denied. We were waitlisted. So we don't really know what that means.
Well, now it seems to mean you're not going to get it at all.
Right. Yeah, we're not planning on it. We're not planning on it. But I will say, you know, I know a couple of the folks had asked the question about, you know, our elected officials. And I drove down to Albany and talked to the director at OTDA, and specifically who oversees this program. And I really made the case for the fact that this is impacting, and I speak on behalf of on the administrative side, but also my work began as in case management. And so I can attest to every single agency here, how effective those agencies are. And, you know, I specifically remember a young woman early on in my case management career who I started working with when she was still in jail. And I was able to place for her in Jennifer House coming out of jail. She was pregnant. She was pregnant as a result of a sexual assault. And she really wanted to be a mom. And without that transition, there was no other place in the community that would have provided that for her. That child would have been born into foster care. That mom may have never been able to reconnect. And but because of that support, she was able to have a healthy baby and get her life back on track. So I'm speaking kind of on behalf of both the agencies that have lost cuts and also on behalf of agencies that could use the benefit as well, because we know that transitional housing and rapid rehousing and prevention measures in terms of security deposits and things, they work. We've been tracking our data. 50% of the people we have to turn away, we could avoid entering the shelter system altogether just by offering some rapid rehousing mm-hmm. funds. And so to hear that kind of funding being cut is significant, because now we're looking at our systems being overloaded and not nearly enough resources to provide and meet the need.
John is talking about a concern that we could see, you know, what some refer to as a tent city grow again in this community. Do you think that would happen?
Well, it's an interesting dynamic there, because oftentimes families with children go undetected in the homeless system. So Peace Village may see an influx of single adults, and that could very well be the case here. But when you're looking at specifically agencies that directly serve women and children, mm-hmm. I think we're going to see a much more an equally critical issue, and that's people going under the radar. So moms
who where do they go?
So they're going to go back to unsafe situations, transient living situations, sleeping on couches and floors, maybe returning to an abusive partner, and because there's nowhere else to go. And as a mom with children, you don't want to be on the radar, because you're terrified that you're going to lose your children if people know how you're living.
Listeners, if you want to join the program as we talk about homelessness in the greater Rochester area, particularly as we head for the winter months, you can call 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. It's 263-WXXI, 263-9994 if you're in Rochester, and it's connections at WXXI.org. A listener named Alex wants to know, is this primarily a city issue? How are suburban and rural areas affected? And I'll kind of open that up to the floor here. I mean, do we view homelessness more concentrated as a city issue, or is this an issue that really sort of crosses those boundaries? Angela?
Well, I'll speak for, as you address the issue of women and families, that cuts across the county. Our clients, our residents who come to our shelter may have been, as you put it, couch surfing. They've been, you know, spending a day here or a day there with a friend or family member. But that's from across the county until something happens that they can't continue that any longer. So this is not just a city issue, not just concentrated in Tent City. And that's what I think is very important for people to understand.
Okay. You agree with that,
agree.
Anna?
Yeah. 100%.
Yes. Okay. Pastor?
I would agree with that, too. I mean, I think one of the things with churches is we get lots of calls from people from all over the mm-hmm. city, the county, looking for money for rent, to get out of homelessness. And so I don't think at all that it's just a city problem. I mean, in my career as a pastor, mm-hmm. I've seen hundreds and hundreds of men and women from both the city and the county who are seeking help.
Yeah, I know WXXI has reported on this in various ways. Our colleagues at WROC recently reported, cited the National Alliance to End Homelessness as saying that on any given night there are approximately 835 people without a home in Monroe County. Though when I say without a home, I mean, to that point, I think that Anna, that Pastor Brown are making, that Angela is making, I don't know how we actually quantify this. You know, we sometimes have a very limited view of homelessness. Fair?
Yeah. So one of the things that people often overlook in any official counts that you look at, from the census to the point in time count, is that people who are doubled up are not included in those counts. So when you think of the doubled up population, you're talking about probably a few thousand, 2,000, to, you know, maybe to give a conservative number, and that's just children. So when, and that's in Monroe County. So when we look at that number, about eight, what we know is about 80% of them fall in that doubled up category. The rest are in shelters or staying, you know, maybe in a transitional facility. But what we know is that of those 80%, what we can't know, and that's why it's hard to quantify, is how many of them are in truly unstable or unsafe situations, and how many of them maybe just are staying with some family for a little bit and they're okay. But because we're not counting them at all, we really have no perception of the depth of the crisis.
So let me just ask the most baseline question. From all of your perspectives, is the problem of homelessness and its sort of various ripples, is it getting worse, better? Is it relatively stable in this community, Angela?
Well, the county has released its annual report of homelessness in the county. The 2018 report was the most recent one. I think that was May. They cited through their process, I think 11,000 and change placements into their system that was either in a shelter or a hotel or other kind of transitional housing. That number was up 19% from the prior year, and the 2017 number was up a little over 20% from 2016. So that would tell us, I don't know what the numbers are in 2019 for the county. I can tell you in our facility, our census has been up for women and families.
And I would agree with that. And just for a frame of reference, that number jumped up 19 this year, 20 last year. But the year before that was 12. So we're seeing significant increases.
So even if it were to stabilize, so to speak, you know, if your doctor tells you you got to get the cholesterol under control and it doubles in 1 year and then it doubles the next year, but then the next 3 years it's stable, you say, well, it's stable. Well, it's pretty high compared to where it was. And that doesn't mean that, but we're still seeing increases. So again, the numbers that Angela was just relating, Monroe County reporting that in the last year made more than 11,000 placements of families and individuals to local homeless shelters. That figure was up 19%, previous year 20%, Anna's previous year 12%. So it's been jumping. And do you all see that? And John, I know you're new. You've been here for 3 months. Generally speaking, do you feel like you've been here long enough to kind of get a handle on what the population is?
No, I can't say I got a handle on the population. But I could say, just for the Salvation Army, I've been to 3 months, and I've seen people come through the program. I've seen them get housing. I've had people come now to the church. I got one gentleman who's singing on the worship band. He's now my best friend. So I've seen the success of the programs just in 3 months I've been here. And my worry is that as we cut services, we'll cut our successfulness.
Okay. And go ahead, Angela.
Let's just think about what the drivers are of that increase. I mean, there's some factors that are, unfortunately, we haven't been able to really stem. Women and families escaping abuse or in unsafe conditions. Issues of mental illness, for example. But there are some circumstances in our community that I think are drivers of that increase. The opioid crisis, certainly, and economic instability. The the economic revival in the country, there's no debate, really. It left many, many portions of our population behind. And there are just untold people in the county who are one paycheck away from being homeless. And if something happens in their life, they lose a job, they lose the second job they've had a medical crisis, puts them over the edge, and now they can't afford their apartment, they're evicted, and they're in the system.
Yeah, I mean, this goes back, especially watching the numbers in the last decade since the last financial crash in the late 2000s. And the Obama administration would do this. We see this now. There's a lot of fixation on the unemployment number, which does not count people who are not even trying to find work. And the number of people who are actively looking, considering themselves part of the workforce, is at some of its lowest numbers in 40 years. So, you know, yes, technically the unemployment number is pretty low historically, but that doesn't account for a lot of people who are not even really counted. So that's certainly a concern. And Pastor Brown, Sarah, I'm curious to know from the perspective of Spiritus Christi, have you seen the needs and numbers grow in recent years?
Yes. Yeah, so the needs that the women have and the men have grows, the need for services to be able to wrap around them in order for them to successfully reintegrate into the community and become self-sufficient, productive members of society, that grows. housing needs grows. I mean, everything is growing. The amount of referrals that we receive grows. So we see an increase in, you know, we see an increase in the amount of referrals we get. We see an increase in the needs, especially with the opioid crisis, because most of the people that we serve do struggle with the substance abuse disorder and mental health. So we're seeing the need for effective services, and it's hard to do that with cuts.
On the other side of our only break of the hour, which we've got to get to now, I'm going to read a couple of emails that have come in from listeners. And we will talk about two prongs of this. So some of this is about funding. Some of this is about more than $500,000 in funding cuts that are going to directly impact organizations in our community now going into the winter. But we also can't just solve this problem from funding. I mean, certainly funding is needed and helpful for organizations that do this hard work. Then there are the questions of beyond funding, what it takes. I've got some emails to read, and we'll do that on the other side of this break. Oh, it's a very short break. We were just talking during our brief break about some of the many other issues we're going to have to try to cover in the next 20 minutes. It's already 12:38, and I've got a pile of emails to read. We're talking about the problem of homelessness in our community, and with us in studio, a big slate of guests talking about the work their organizations do. Angela Panzarella is the president and CEO of the YWCA of Rochester and Monroe County. Reverend Myra Brown is the senior pastor at Spiritus Christi Church, and Sarah Lee is also here from Spiritus Christi, the director of Jennifer House. John Sosa is here from the Salvation Army of Greater Rochester. Anna Valeria Eisman, the executive director of the Open Door Mission. And Angela was mentioning during our brief break that we are talking about numbers, populations, and the need, number one, for people to have shelter. But in your own individual ways, you're doing more than just providing roofs over heads. Tell me about that.
That's what I think is very important for people to understand. Key for all of us is what we're providing to individuals who are experiencing homelessness is not just a bed at night. That's not just a revolving door of a bed a night and you leave the next day. From the moment an individual comes into any of our programs, the focus of our case management staff and other staff is what are the issues that they were facing that led them to be homeless in the first place? What are their goals? How can we help connect them with resources in the community? How can we help them meet their goals so they transition out of our shelter into some place that is stable and safe and evolve the revolving door back into the system?
Okay. John, you want to add to that?
Well, in my experience, I found that to help folks who are struggling with homelessness, a lot of it that I've experienced is coming alongside these people, letting them feel loved and appreciated, making them feel human again, because a lot of times these folks really feel subhuman. And even in my experience with Peaceful Village or Tent City, first time I went out there, they would come out, maybe get something to eat and be gone back in their tents. But like Sunday night when we were out there, they were out there hanging out with us, talking with us. And I could just see us breaking through as you start to make these people feel valued and, you know, and loved. I think then they have more of a desire to get back into mainstream society. So that's kind of my experience.
You know, Sarah, you want to add a little bit? I know you've been talking about the work that Jennifer House does here, but I think that it's important to keep that frame in mind that we're not just talking about beds, which are important, or roof overheads, which are important.
Yeah. At Jennifer House and Nielsen House, we provide a home to people, and we, you know, we try to love them and care for them a lot of times until they can love themselves and feel a sense of worth and a sense of belonging. And our houses are ran very family-oriented, and, you know, we have a beautiful environment at both houses that helps them. You know, it's hard to think your way in a better living. You have to live your way into better thinking. And that's huge, you know. And if you have places like Spiritus Christi, Jennifer House, and the other places that are around the table that do provide that care and constant contact and that support, then we see the results are greater. You know, we have the women and the men, they're like family. We're a family, you know. We eat at dinner at the table at the same time. We wake up at the table at the same time. You know, we have coffee. We have a dog in the house. I mean, this is a home, you know. This is their home, and this is a, you know, we're a family. And that's huge. That changes the numbers significantly when we're talking about success rates. You know, and our programs are set up so that, yes, it's structured, but it's phases of development. And then they feel comfortable enough after so long of being there to actually go out into the community and have a voice. You know, when you suffer from substance abuse and mental health, you know, I can say personally, because I am in recovery, I can say personally, there's something about using drugs that it takes your voice away. no matter what your goals are, no matter what your dreams are, no matter what your ambitions are, does all of that is subsided. The drugs and the alcohol and mental illness, it decapitates your voice. It takes it right from you. And when you have somebody that's willing to show you how to talk again, how to speak again, how to live again, how to love again, how to be part of, you can't put that into words. I mean, the things that we, the spiritual principles that we try to help people instill again, integrity and honesty and, you know, self-worth and preservation and perseverance and all of these spiritual principles that people, that, you know, good human beings have, you know, that's not, it goes way beyond funding. It goes way beyond funding cuts. You know, it comes down to, do we have enough people in this house to even call it a family? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And when we're talking about case management, we're talking about the services that the case managers do and the people do. And then across the board, from the state to the county, down to the grants, down to the people that donate and the volunteers. I mean, it's a huge production, you know, and we hate to see any part of that puzzle piece, that piece fall off the puzzle, you know, because we know that it's critical.
Anna?
Repeat the question.
Well, we're talking about more than just roofs overhead and the mission and the work that's happening underneath those roofs.
Yeah. Yeah, the mission, when we did our research for how we were going to serve women and children, when we knew there was a gap in services there, specifically with the homeless student population, we knew that we weren't going to be able to get this publicly funded, because we know that the trend over the past several years has been away from transitional and, I'll say it, effective housing models. and we knew that we had to be able to create an environment like that where we're serving not just the person, but the soul and the family unit, and trying to create a way to strengthen that family unit. And I think that what we're seeing here, I think a bigger, broader issue here is that New York State is following a trend that HUD has followed over the past several years in kind of controlling all of the funds into serving a portion of the homeless population. And we're not saying that we need to not fund that portion of the homeless population, but we need to balance it out a little bit. You know, we need to be able to fund transitional programs. If we're funding only the chronically homeless, we're missing a big gap with families and children, because they're not on the radar. And oftentimes they're not going to ever be qualified as chronic, because they can find those couches or floors to stay on for a day or two at a time.
Let me take a phone call. This is Jane in Rochester. Go ahead, Jane.
Yeah, what was just said about transitional housing, I don't quite understand. But we do hear a lot from developers. There's a lot of development going on around here with apartments and so forth. And we always hear from them that, I've got my radio on. Is it off? Okay.
Yeah, what was just said about...
Oh, my gosh. Anyway, I'm hearing an echo, so I thought I had my radio on. But we hear that they're taking into consideration the homeless and so forth, and want to get plenty of affordable housing. And I'm wondering how much that has to do with the problem that they haven't anteed up with that yet. And I want to tell you one little experience I had. I used to live in HUD housing down south, and I had an immediate neighbor who was disabled. And he only paid $30 a month, and that's the way I read it, that it's supposed to, you know, go as long, maybe just even zero. But if you had the affordable housing and people had no source of income, as I understand it, they still get HUD housing. So that's why I'm thinking there's not enough of that. And one other thing, Evan, we've got the money. We've got the money. We are repairing lakefront, all those houses, and in another year or two, they'll need to be repaired again. We're still giving grants for people to build. We've got a gym downtown. So it is about where we put the money and what our values are. And I think those tents that were mentioned should be taken to Albany. Thank you.
Jane, thank you for that. So let me ask our guests then, as we think about what the resources are in this community. You know, Pastor Brown, do you agree with Jane when she says we've got the money if we want to do this?
Yeah. I hope so. I think that we do have the money. And I do think she's right that there is development, and we have actually benefited from some of that development. Some of our men and women who come out of our programs are able to go into that affordable housing, and I think that is a needed area. But I would agree with Anna. I think the conversation here is that we need to make sure that we're attending to the needs of all those who are impacted by the homelessness. And I think there are people who are missing. You know, I just think I had a conversation this week, a phone call from an 80-year-old who had mental illness and who is in danger of being evicted on Friday, right? And so she needs a safety net. And so I think there are lots of pockets of people that are missing from having that kind of safety net. And I think that it does require that we kind of look at all of the folks who are impacted by it. And so I do think that the money's there. I think we have to be really creative about finding it and deciding where it goes and making sure that we don't leave anybody out.
Before I ask the other guests to weigh in, I think the call dovetails with an email that I'm going to go ahead and read that came to us from Dave. And Dave said the following, Evan and guests, listening to this, I am so very sad that so many desperate people are so at risk by a very bad decision at the state level. I'm so sad and angry listening to this show. And I'm also sad and angry that our society very repeatedly does this sort of thing. It's a crime against the desperate. Here in Vancouver, where he's listening from, lip service and some real attempts are given to reducing homelessness, but homelessness grows and grows. I was shocked riding a bus through our downtown east side very early one morning. There must have been thousands of people sleeping side by side on the sidewalk in one of the richest cities in the world. That a person can be so desperate at all in our so very rich societies is a terrible indictment of our societies. And I hope your show leads to a big response that reaches state lawmakers and a reversal of these terrible cuts. All the best. That is from Dave, listening via the mobile app in Vancouver, Canada. Thank you, Dave. I appreciate that. And so let me ask our guests to sort of build on the points that that Jane was making, that Myra was making. Is it as simple as saying that we're a rich society and that we should not stand for this, or is it more complex than that? Anna Valeria Eisman, I'll start with you.
I do think it's a little bit more complex than that, but I also think that it's kind of a both and. I think we know that there were funds available from STEP. We know there were funds that how they were prioritized and how they were distributed tells a different story than what we've seen them fund and prioritize before. And it also speaks to the fact that they're rejecting programs that are really being effective and working. And so I think that is a significant issue. And how can we change that? On my little tour after the awards were announced, I went down to Albany and talked to them. But I also went and visited our local elected state officials. And many of them were very supportive in the extent of, send me the support letter mm-hmm. and I'll sign it. And there was one that said, well, are you not in our district? Well, we serve everyone across the county, so that was another issue. But at the end of the day, I think if we had a team of elected officials from Monroe County to coordinate and submit some, points of advocacy at the state level to say, listen, this is the impact that these agencies are having. Is there a middle ground? Is there something we can do to offset the impact that this is going to have?
Okay, Angela?
But it's also important that regardless of what the final decision mm-hmm. is from the state, and I too am hopeful that perhaps we can eventually get some more mm-hmm. support from the state, we also have to look to our local community, and yes. that's going to be our county officials to see what opportunities do they see to help support us, because, again, if we close beds, the impact is going to be felt within the county right here at home. And it's also important that people within our community understand this short-term crunch that we're under. This has been a very generous community, the community of Rochester Monroe County, and I'm hopeful that people listening, if they're moved, will reach out in ways to support the affected agencies to help address this issue. Again, long-term, we're going to do what we can to find alternative funding, but our issue is right now.
I think we have seen enough evidence that says that individual or even sort of collective local philanthropy can do a lot in intermediate situations. When there is a gap, when there is a cut, when there is a loss, a generous community, even as generous as Western New York, cannot solve all of this on its own just through philanthropy, unfortunately. But you are saying that in this moment,
yes,
you could use it.
We certainly could use it.
Well, then let's be direct here. And WXXI endorses your membership and your, and your contributions to WXXI. And when I ask them, I'm going to give them the floor to tell you if, that if you want to help, they need your help. And it's not an endorsement from this journalist, but I think that you ought to hear it. And so if, let's start with the YWCA. How can you get help?
Please come to, you can come to our website, ywcarochester.org. On the front page, it's easy to find ways to donate, and we would so appreciate it.
Okay.
Well, from
John?
Salvation Army, obviously, starting November 11th, we'll be having a Red Kettle campaign. So as you go out Christmas shopping, you'll see many bell ringers out there at Red Kettles. We just ask the community to please be very generous because every donation will help. Somebody once said the entire ocean is altered by a single stone. So if everybody could throw a little pebble into the kettle, we could hopefully make a difference.
Okay. Sarah, Pastor Brown?
So you can donate at Spiritus Christi's website, Spiritus Christi Church.
www.spirituschristi.org.
Yep.
That's a donation button.
That is a donation button for Spiritus. And we also have an annual gala every April. And so thinking moving forward in the spring. If you feel springy and want to come to the gala, we would love to have you there. And that's another awesome way to donate to the prison outreach.
Anna Valera Eisman from Open Door Mission.
OpenDoorMission.com. But I'm going to go a little bit off the book and hope my board isn't listening and say I really would encourage people not only to give to us, but really to give to the agencies that lost the funding today. Because we know firsthand, again, we planned for the event that we did not receive the grant, but we know firsthand how much of an impact these other agencies have, and we want to see them supported.
Yeah, the only one not on the program, not available to join us today, was the Volunteers of America. They lost $101,000 in this grant. Mm-hmm. The YWCA, again, $174,000 in lost funding from this grant, the Salvation Army, $247,000. Spiritus Christi, more than $32,000 for the various programs that you have been hearing described this hour. Let's try to squeeze in one more phone call. This is Andrew in Irondequoit. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hey, you guys have a tough job ahead of you. I don't know how you're going to solve it. Is this new renter law going to discourage landlords from renting to people and cause a bigger problem in the subject you're talking about?
Andrew, I think it's a fair question, and we had a recent conversation between those who had advocated for the change in renter rights that passed, I think, in June, mm-hmm. along with some, essentially, some landlords who have a couple hundred units who really work with populations that were formerly homeless. These are a couple of brothers who joined us on the program who they do a lot of advocacy work. They are obviously involved in trying to help people. They are concerned that there are unintended consequences here that will make it harder for people who are homeless to get what you would call affordable housing or housing, just roofs over their head. But I think we're going to need time with this. I don't know that we know already. I think there are there's some optimism. But there's also some concern of unintended consequences. I wonder if our guests have anything they want to add to this particular one. Angela?
I think you're spot on. I think it will take time. I think that long term, I think that landlords and the court systems will adjust to this change. But I am concerned as well that for there may be some immediate pushback and reluctance on the part of people to deal with this change in law. But that is one factor why some of the funding that we lost was going to rapid rehousing in the form of security deposits. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest obstacles individuals have in a homeless shelter to get out of the shelter and into an apartment mm-hmm. is saving for a security mm-hmm. deposit. The step funding provided some resources yeah. Yeah. for that, and we've lost it.
Yeah, so it's Andrew, it's a complicated question. I mean, the goal is to make sure people aren't so easily evicted that they are constantly on the move or thrown out. And that is, I think, probably an understandable and noble goal. Some landlords are responding by increasing credit score requirements mm-hmm. or changing certain requirements that would start to narrow who would be able to be eligible. So, you know, let's track it. Let's talk in 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, and see where we are with this because we need to be very careful. The law is really well intended. It's a question of the outcomes, and we will be following that. I'm going to close the hour just by turning back to John for one point here. John, you mentioned being alongside people who are homeless and thinking the word that came to my mind was dignity. Everyone deserves dignity. What do you see when you actually develop relationships and remind yourselves that these are human beings, fellow human beings who are struggling?
Yes, well, as I was a Janet said
Sarah.
Janet, okay.
Sarah, yeah.
Eating with people, spending time with them, fellowshipping with them. It's very important because we sit there and we hear the problems. I'm a pastor also, and you hear people's problems. They pour out their emotions. And you see, these are normal people who maybe just made a bad decision or something bad happened to them. And you hear their fears, and it's so heartbreaking at times when we feel handcuffed that we can't help them. And I just think people want to be loved and be valued.
I'm really appreciative of that message because there's a book, by the way. We're going to try to get the author. Chris Arnotti is his name, and his book is called Dignity. He traveled the country for years talking to people who are really struggling. And it is a remarkable portrait of human beings in this country who are often forgotten. And there are many people who are often forgotten in this community, but not by the people in studio you heard this hour. And that was John Sosa from the Salvation Army, Anna Valeria Eisman from Open Door Mission, Sarah Lee and the Reverend Myra Brown, the pastor of Spiritus Christi Church, Angela Panzarella from the YWCA. Thanks to all of you for the work you're doing. Thank you.
Thanks for taking
time.
Thank you.
Short break, more connections coming up.